Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 19th of June. A delight to have you all with us on this day. We have a really great panel and a lot to talk about, and we'll get right to it. Just a reminder, you can always join us. All you have to do is write to us via email, panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. We'd love to hear what is on your mind. Let me introduce the group to you. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Morning, Big Joe. You've got a terrific panel today. Good day for me to shut up and listen.
No, we need you. We need you. We always need you. We had her back yesterday after the momentous DACA decision, and she's back with us. If you missed that for some reason, Sarah Rogerson, a longtime member of our panel, left us for a little while because she went off to make her community better and run for school board. And she won her election on Tuesday and is now able to be with us, and we couldn't be more thrilled. So we welcome Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson, back to the program. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Good morning. Happy to be back.
Wonderful to have you back. Sienna Freeman Tolbert is an immigration attorney and associate with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. She made her debut last week, and we're thrilled to have her back this week. Sienna, thank you very much for being here.
Good morning.
And we also welcome president of the Albany branch of the NAACP, Deborah Brown Johnson, who is back for another go-around with us. Good morning, Deborah. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let me begin. Obviously, I want to get to DACA. I do want to begin, though, with a couple of stories in regards to what today is, and that is, of course, Juneteenth. And Deborah, I'm interested in your thoughts. Let's start with you, and then we'll go around the room here. But of the importance of this day and what you make of the increased importance and the fact that many state governments and even national efforts to make this either a state holiday, a federal holiday, or both.
Good morning. Thank you. I, the NAACP, we see this as an important opportunity to recognize historically some of the issues that have impacted African Americans in this country. And if we look at individuals having been enslaved, and then you have a situation here that Juneteenth recognized, is that 2 years after the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, that there were enslaved people in Texas who did not know until that time. And so it's a recognition of the ending of slavery, if you will, in this country and the movement forward. I think it's particularly important now, although it has been celebrated in states and countries and states and communities around the country, it's important now with what is happening now and the recognition of the situations and the issues impacting the daily life of African Americans and people of color in this country. So the significance of what is happening with the governor declaring a state holiday, with some of the county and some of the city offices recognizing this, is that the timing, the connection of the timing cannot be lost, that it's important with what is happening and the movement that we are seeing ourselves in, and the significance of understanding the plight of African Americans in this country.
This is no surprise to you, of course, and to many listening to us, probably have heard this, but the president is seeking to take credit for making Juneteenth, a day commemorating the end of slavery in the United States, quote unquote, very famous after rescheduling his first rally since the start of the pandemic. Trump told the Wall Street Journal yesterday that, quote, nobody had ever heard of the holiday before he brought it up. Quote, I did something good. I made Juneteenth very famous, Trump said in reference to the rally date in an interview published yesterday. It's actually an important event, an important time, but nobody had ever heard of it. Your response to that, Deborah?
Well, we know, in fact, that that isn't true. And just because someone says something doesn't make it so. And I think that we have seen what the individual who occupies the White House likes to take claim for things that is not proper for him. This is one of those things. And we know it's not true.
Sienna?
I found the comment very highly insensitive, because if you recall, the meaning of Juneteenth is that these slaves in Texas did not know that they were free for 2 years. And so for the president to take that opportunity to say people didn't know about Juneteenth, it just came off as very insensitive, because Juneteenth is about a lack of information given to these slaves in Texas. And that's why, for me, Juneteenth means a day of education, a reminder to inform yourself. That's what Juneteenth stands for me.
Alan?
Well, if I can find the microphone. Oh, yeah, there it is. Yes, the answer is that it's a very important thing that we're doing here, because we have a racist society, and this is going to be a constant reminder what racism has brought to this country, what it is. And so I think the idea that we make a holiday out of this is terribly, terribly important. Not only that, I got to say that the Yiddish word that applies here is chutzpah. I mean, here is this racist guy who has inflamed people, and now he wants to take credit for having done something for black people. Let me ask you a question. How do we think for a single second that he can get away with it? Well, he tries to get away with anything, and he is continuing to do that. Chutzpah is the word.
Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah, so, you know, immigrant rights are bound up in racial justice movements. Our immigration system is explicitly racist from the jump. And so, you know, it's also sort of fascinating not to dwell too much on what the occupier of the White House said. But, you know, maybe if we reminded him of that, he wouldn't be so quick to claim it, since he seems to distance himself explicitly from black and brown immigrants every time he gets the chance. So I'm going to choose to celebrate this day independent of what he has said. And I'm glad to say that Albany Law School also gave everyone the day off today. And I'm going to spend the time reflecting and educating myself on how to be a more effective ally and anti-racist.
So let me go back to you, Deborah, on that very point. What is a good way for us, whether we are African American or if we are allies, of how the best way to celebrate this day?
I think the point has been made. It is important for us to educate ourselves, to understand that when you look at the day and the fact that 2 years post the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, there were a group of enslaved people who did not know. That speaks to what was happening at that time, and what was happening to black and brown people, and what is still happening to people when we look at what's going on today. The lack of information, the lack of not knowing the experiences, understanding the experiences, and even to the point of recognizing that those experiences have happened to people. This becomes the opportunity to learn, to really learn about the history of America, because it's not just the history of African Americans. It's the history of America, because we were here and we are part of our experience, is part of the American experience. So that's what this time becomes for us, to recognize that, to understand what has happened, and to reflect on what do we want to do to make the change that should happen. How do we fit in as individuals in creating a new environment, a new situation that is respectful to everyone, that's inclusive of everyone, and that we take action ourselves to work on, you know, dismantling racism in our community, in our state, in our country, and the world.
Just a note that, in case you forgot, and why would you have, but the president originally had his rally scheduled for tonight on Juneteenth in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It is, after bowing to pressure, he has moved it to tomorrow. Meanwhile, organizers of the I Too Am America, Juneteenth Rally for Justice will be happening in Tulsa tonight, or today rather, where Donald Trump postponed that speech. Al Sharpton, the civil rights leader, will be the keynote speaker and says, quote, "We'll be calling for sweeping reforms within the Tulsa Police Department and nationwide." So that will be one of the key events in Tulsa as a result of really what we've been living through over the past several weeks in the police killing of George Floyd, but also in response to the president's planned rally, right? We'll say yes.
Yeah. But, you know, I think if I could just add to that, I think it's important when you go back to your earlier comment in terms of the comment that was made that he made Juneteenth famous. The fact that he was going to plan to schedule a rally on the day means that he didn't know. He didn't understand. He didn't respect what was happening. Not that other people didn't. And so I think it's important for everyone. That's why I go back to my statement. Just because someone says something doesn't make it so. And people need to recognize and look at what's all around them. Take in information and be able to use their mind and make a discerning decision based on what they see and hear and read and understand, not just because someone throws out a flippant remark that now becomes the statement. And I think it's important for us to realize that and look at it for what it is.
You know, you look at it and you say, for the president, this must be a very hard concept to understand, you know, like Finland. right? I just, you know, those things that are a little difficult. Sienna, any thoughts on this?
You know, I was reflecting this Juneteenth on this Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben's situation. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about education. And I was just very uninformed about the history of the Aunt Jemima ad. Mm-hmm. And I realized I have these in my house.
Right.
Like, why do I have these in my house? And it shows how normalized microaggressions and systematic racism is. I had black minstrel figures in my house on my box. And so this Juneteenth, that's why I'm reflecting about that educating ourselves about those different microaggressions, those different symbols of glorious South, so to speak. What can we do about that? How can we advance?
Cream of wheat included in that as well.
Cream of wheat, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Butterworth, we should mention. And as you say, Sienna, it is interesting because we, you know, many of us have these items in our home, and we get them without thinking. And but it is good, especially in the case the companies. What I find interesting, Sienna, is these companies have bowed to pressure, but this pressure has been going on for years, and now is finally the moment.
And it's so interesting because this 2020, I heard someone said, give people 2020 vision. And so it's made people look deeper. It's made people hold a mirror up to themselves. And I'm excited about this progress. I'm excited.
You know, Alan, and just before we go to break, it's just the, as we were talking about the president and his comments, but the overall ignorance of these things that, you know, many of us know and are certainly learning, or at least are open to learning. Do you believe, I know we've had this discussion many times, of that when he says something like this, if nobody knew about it before I did it, what's the political calculus in that, and do you believe there is one?
Well, we do know, Joe, that he's appealing to the base. We've said it so many times, it's become almost an idiom, appealing to the base, appealing to the base. However, there aren't enough people in the base to elect them. And that's what's so puzzling about all of this. It's the purples, it's the people in the middle who are making up their mind. And by the way, all the polling now, including the polls most identified with the Republicans, including Fox, are finding a huge number of people for Biden and opposed to Trump. And much of it is based on the fact that they see him as an embarrassing ignoramus, which he is. But what his thinking is beyond me. Now, maybe, like Joe Biden says, he thinks he can steal the election. Maybe he can. We know he's trying not to get people registered. He's trying to not let people vote. We know all of that. Nevertheless, he keeps thinking, and I can't quite figure out what's on his mind, if anything.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Deborah Brown-Johnson. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable on this Juneteenth, and we welcome you. We also welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Deborah Brown-Johnson joining us on the program this morning. Have a few letters on the topic that we were discussing at the beginning of Juneteenth, the president's remark and some of the branding. So we have letters to be talking about that. We go to Luigi said the Emancipation Proclamation was issued more than a year before the end of the war and only applied to the states in rebellion, not to Union states that still held slaves. There would be no reason for Texas or any other state of the Confederacy to comply with freeing their slaves at the time, but forced to do so after the war was lost. We go to Sally has an answer to Alan's question that maybe Trump is trying to be the biggest loser of all time. I guess time will tell on that.
You may remember, Joe, that a while back in my favorite word, contradistinction to Rosemary, who I had, we had a little bit of a tiff over whether or not
a go round.
Whether Trump was going to win, and she thought at the time Trump was going to win. And he still may, of course, but he is falling like a stone in all of the polls. So right now I have a certain amount of hope. Joe Biden said that Trump is going to try to steal the election, and I believe that. I think that's right. Nevertheless, his numbers keep going down, not up.
Brian writes about Aunt Jemima says, not only is Aunt Jemima a racial insult, it's not fit for human consumption. That from Brian. We also got Rhonda who says, you know, Mickey Mouse is a minstrel character. Is that true? Do we know that? I don't know that. Another Nancy writes in and says that not for nothing, Juneteenth is now on the Google calendar. Suzanne says, of course, saying something doesn't make it so, but that's the explanation for Trump's 38%. He says, whatever, no matter how absurd, they believe it. That from Susanna in Scroon Lake.
Yeah, but wait. I'd love to hear from the panel on this one. It isn't that he's fooling them. He is the leader of them, and they are the racists. I mean, there's a racist group in this United States that won't go away. So to say that Trump is the guy who has convinced them, I don't think that's so. I think he just recognizes his opportunities and has taken them.
Anybody else on that?
I'm with Alan. I think it's an opportunism that has sort of been a hallmark of his presidency ever since Charlottesville. And even much, even before, as he was on the campaign trail and using slurs.
One more letter. Exactly. Go ahead. You want to say more about that?
No. I was just going to agree exactly on his campaign was based on separation of people of races and racism. And so he ran on that. And there's a segment of folks who believe as he does. And so he's not creating the situation. He is taking advantage of those who believe like him, like he does.
A huge group of people. We're talking about constant 38% of the American people. That is really frightening.
Well, I don't think all of them are racist individuals. And that, you know, Ibram Kendi, who you've had on the program, Joe, I think you interviewed him about his book, his most recent book, How to Be an Anti-Racist.
Right.
He makes the point that we have racist institutions and that race is about contributing to that and not acknowledging your beliefs. And you know, we see a lot of these videos of people to varying degrees. And I'm not talking about law enforcement. I'm talking, you know, usually white women on the street antagonizing and sometimes being overtly racist. Right. And some of them say, well, that's not me. That's not who I am. And yet here's their behavior. So I think that there are other Trump supporters who are also opportunists that we have to remember that are willing to, even if they're not personally racist or hold racist views, they're willing to contribute to an institution that's racist explicitly in order to personally advantage themselves and further their privilege. And whether they're doing so consciously or unconsciously doesn't really matter. But I think it would be that there's a lot of complexity in there, and to win votes from that pool, which I still think we can do, requires us all to have an understanding of what is motivating that 38%, aside from overt racism.
Alan?
Well, you know, far be it for me to fight on that one. However, I think if you're going along with it, you are it. It's that simple.
Absolutely.
Sienna?
Yeah.
You know, my only thought that I keep reminding myself is that in order to eradicate systematic racism, you have to change hearts. And that is a tall order. So when I look at individuals that support Trump or who may be racist or who may just take advantage of privilege, so to speak, the only thing that can eradicate that is education. And I think what's happening now is it's in their face. Black Lives Matter is in your face. All these resources are out there. And even if these companies are just giving or just saying the right thing right now, they're saying it and they're calling people to have these conversations in these difficult conversations, and that's how you change hearts, and that's how you eradicate racism.
Deborah?
I agree that education is pivotal here. It's important. I think people's experience is what sometimes would guide how they think and some of the things that they do. I'm concerned because I don't want to segment out racist behavior, because if you act on it, if your behavior is to keep someone else down because of the color of their skin, you're operating in that realm. And so if my work with you and your willingness is to have a conversation, to have those tough talks, to talk about what your experiences may have been or what you had learned that brought you to this place, I'm open to that. And at the NAACP, we are open to that. But I'm concerned because I don't want people to think it's okay, you know, if you're manipulating situations. If your manipulation is, you know, keeping someone down so that you can be up or a group can be up and you're keeping them down, you're oppressing them because of the color of their skin, you're in that space.
John writes to us and says, what Trump said about Juneteenth is like a band of Vikings saying that they deserve credit for making the Irish realize how important their largest monastery was by burning it to the ground. We will hold there. After that note, we welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. When we come back, the group will discuss the DACA decision laid down by the Supreme Court yesterday. Lots to discuss there. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Deborah Brown-Johnson, all on the program this morning. We'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We welcome your thoughts, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We talk about the Supreme Court blocking President Trump's bid to end DACA, a win for undocumented dreamers. The Supreme Court on Thursday rejected the Trump administration's attempt to dismantle the program protecting undocumented immigrants brought to the United States as children, a reprieve for nearly 650,000 recipients known as dreamers. The 5-4 decision written by Chief Justice John Roberts stunned President Trump, who said in a tweet that it and a ruling earlier this week that federal law protects LGBTQ workers were shotgun blasts into the face of people that are proud to call themselves Republicans or conservatives. Roberts was in the majority in both cases, and Thursday's ruling showed once again the pivotal role he now plays at the center of the court. Shortly after the decision was laid down yesterday, we did have Sarah on our program. Alan and I spoke with her. So, Sienna, given that you are also an immigration attorney and very much focusing your practice on all aspects of immigration law, what do you make of this particular decision?
I was very excited about this decision because I understand that it's a sort of stopgap, right? They're saying that it really gave Trump the roadmap to terminate DACA eventually. But I know what this would have looked like if it was not a favorable decision. We have watched over the last 18 months as ICE officers have gone into family homes and arrested mothers, children, fathers, and deported them. And I knew that if this was not a favorable decision, ICE was ready to go and pick up these students who were now out of status. They have the jails, detention centers, I should say, to place them in. They have to go through bond hearings. They have to go into court. And if they already had a removal order, they would have been deported. So I am celebrating yesterday's decision because I understand how many families get to stay together for the next few months.
So are you celebrating John Roberts? I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I have real admiration for Roberts on one count, and that is that he is doing, in my mind, he is looking at this and saying, this ain't right. This just ain't right, and I'm not going to go along with it. He did it with health care and putting all those people off of their health care. You know, he's done it on LGBTQ rights. Look, the guy's a social conservative. He's a fiscal conservative, but he's trying to save the court. So I got to give him an awful lot of credit.
Sienna?
I completely agree.
And Sarah, any thoughts that from what we talked about yesterday of since you've had almost a day to process this, of what came of this and as a result of what we were just discussing as well?
Yeah, I guess to Alan's question, there used to be such a thing called compassionate conservatism. Do you all remember that?
Mm. Sure. I remember them saying it anyway.
Yeah, it was an attempt at rebranding, right?
Yeah.
I think, and it was when I was becoming more politically aware. I've always been interested in politics ever since I was a little girl. But like when I was 10 years old, listening to Ronald Reagan give the State of the Union, I didn't identify those things as trickle-down economics, for example, eluded me. I was just a 10-year-old watching the president. But once I started to really gain more of a political awareness and learn what those terms were being held out to mean, well, when I say that, you know, and listening to people sort of self-identify that way, I wonder if that's part of what's going on here, is a reclaiming of the Republican ideals or values in a certain way. I don't think that's what the justice is doing. I think the justice is the way that the issue was teed up is it's a very clean legal analysis. The Administrative Procedures Act is not something that probably most people, aside from the folks on this panel, that's where you find a lot of civil rightsy type stuff in this really boring statute, and it's kind of a dry read compared to a lot of the other opinions that we hold up as being progressive wins in the Supreme Court, right? And I think I made this point yesterday. It's still a conservative reading of the law, a lot of what Roberts does. And so I don't know. I don't know if there's a version of all that stuff mashed together to see what the new Republican Party, if it still exists after November, what it looks like. Because I think that there are a lot of people who are uncomfortable with Trumpism. And I think that's where a lot of his numbers are falling. And I wonder, by the time you get to the Supreme Court, unless you're Kavanaugh, you have done a lot of deep thinking about federalism and these issues, which really this was an opinion about checks and balances as well. You know, what are the requirements for the executive when making policy?
Alan?
Joe, if I can. There's a political aspect to this that is fascinating to me, and I think to an awful lot of other people. Remember who Roberts was appointed by. He was appointed by a Bush. Mm-hmm. And the Bushes clearly hate Trump's guts for exactly the reason Sarah just talked about. He has led the Republican Party into an absolute certainty that they will be a minority party by the time this is all over. So I'm thinking that Roberts had to be taking some clues from George W. here. Now, we think of George W. as a conservative and all the rest, but in fact, it is clear that the Bush wing of the Republican Party, going along with what Sarah has just said, are furious about the hijacking of the Republican Party, which is almost 100%. You know, for Trump, they don't get off the dime. They don't move. And so I'm not surprised from a political point of view that Roberts did this.
When you look at where this goes from here, and I know we touched on this yesterday, but so what's the road ahead, Sarah? Where do we go from here for the Dreamers? And I realize a lot of this depends on what happens in November, right?
Yep, it's a super long road still. Sienna can probably chime in here too, but from what I'm seeing, the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services is already working to limit the reach of this order. They're issuing statements that signal an intention not to accept new DACA applications. So the impact of the ruling, like, is it going back to reopening the application process, or are we still stuck in the same situation where we can file for people who already made it through that gatekeeper mechanism, right? Because there are still like 50,000 New Yorkers who could still benefit from this program, according to some estimates, and were unable to apply or get access to counsel to apply because it's not an easy process before the program was suspended, essentially. So a lot of questions remain. There's also still a barrier in place for folks trying to leave the country to go visit their family or even just take a trip. If you're a DACA recipient, you can't get what's called advanced parole, which is permission to leave the country for a certain period of time for travel and then come back. So there are lots of things to still fight over. The DACA litigation will still continue in the lower courts. We're definitely not out of the woods yet. Congress needs to act. Mm-hmm. And if in November we get a Congress that can function, then, you know, we have real hope for comprehensive immigration reform. But we all have to vote. It's all in November. Everything is riding on November.
Yeah, okay.
Sienna?
And I would agree with Sarah. There's definitely not enough clarity on what this decision means, what the real life implications are. Because remember, it's not just USCIS individuals who have do not have the DACA status right now and are walking around. It's also individuals who are in immigration court. And the judge is waiting to decide whether or not they can issue a removal order. So the lack of clarity is so frustrating for my clients right now because it determines whether they stay or go. So we really need legislation right now.
You know, this morning the NPR had a senior Bush advisor on, guy they have quite frequently, well-spoken, sounds reasonable. He's not, but he sounds reasonable. And basically, I agree with both with everything that has been said here. They're saying, we're not going to live with this decision. We're not going to live with this. We're going to contest this decision. They told us we didn't do it right. We'll do it right next time. He didn't say those words, but that's what he's saying.
Sarah?
Yeah, that's
Joe.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I didn't mean to cut it. I just wanted to, for the panel and your listeners, that the NAACP was also a party to this lawsuit. And we celebrate the victory here and also listening to what Sienna and Sarah are saying. I know our president and CEO of the national NAACP, Derek Johnson, called it a tremendous victory for America. And recognize that the voices of immigrants are not always heard, and this was an opportunity too. But listening to the other comments, the other panelists, I think there are things that we still need to be vigilant about what happens next.
Sienna?
When it comes to immigration, the Trump administration loves to put up roadblocks and obstacles. And so where I celebrated this decision, I know that they are going to try to terminate the DACA program. And so it's very important that, let me just say this. When we were doing, when they were talking about Juneteenth and all the organizations and that are recognizing it and making a national holiday and a state holiday, what kept running through my mind as this DACA decision came down, is how great would it be if Election Day was a national holiday? Because right now, that's what we need. We need to vote. We need to get this legislation through. I'm just thinking through the long term for my clients, my immigrant clients.
Sarah,
you don't think for a single second that this Republican Senate is going to let that happen? That also goes back to what you're all saying about November. It's so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and voting by mail. I mean, who knows where if we're going to be in COVID part two in the fall, depending on whether or not there's another wave, and as things reopen, sort of the vigilance that people are taking to keep each other safe. Which so far has not proven to really be something that collectively we're willing to undertake. But
Sarah, those Republicans are not going to let any voting by mail happen because we know that as the franchise expands, more Democrats get the vote.
Yeah, it's really interesting because with the school board race, last year, 2,700 people submitted ballots, and this session it was over 6,000, and that we saw record-breaking participation in every single jurisdiction. And I got to tell you, my husband was crunching some numbers, and the ratios still turn out. The ratios between candidates, sort of like the percentage of people that vote on the budget and not the board candidates, like all of those none of the percentages changed, but more people could participate, and that is not a bad thing. And the idea of voter fraud is just de minimis. He had a whole task force on voter fraud that had to disband because they couldn't find any. And so, it's just one of those obvious things that we should definitely do that, Alan, I'm sorry, you're right. They're going to block at every turn.
Absolutely.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many letters on this and other subjects. Terrific panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Deborah Brown Johnson. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. First, we have news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion. Alan Chartok is here, Sarah Rogerson, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Deborah Brown-Johnson making up the panel. And we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. I want to get to the letters in just a second. One of them actually touches on something that I saw in an article in the New York Times that I just wanted to bring up, and maybe Sienna and Sarah can talk a little bit about this. The Times was looking, the question was, how did we get here regarding DACA? And the Times has an article, what is DACA and how did it end up in the Supreme Court? Sarah, let's begin with you. How did this issue end up where it did?
I think it's important to start at the very, very beginning, which is undocumented students who formed a very effective coalition and movement in this country to get the Obama administration to move on this in the first place. We often talk about, you know, where are the youth and what are they doing? And we had the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High students convening in Washington, D.C. And I think we have yet to see the full realization of that movement. But we've already seen a lot of things jog loose in the gun lobby. So it's students. It was a student-centered movement of the directly impacted people, right? Not white people with privilege speaking on behalf of them. And it's important to note that, because once you get to the Supreme Court, that's all it is. It is often the case, I should say. The court is becoming a bit more diverse, but not always. Well, that's a different conversation for a different day. So, but what happened, and I think the majority opinion does a great job of laying out years and years of struggle in a very concise paragraph, but basically two programs were announced, one for kids and then one for their parents, which impacts about 4 million more people, parents of these children, that was supposed to protect them. The state of Texas led the initial charge in federal district court to try to block both programs. The parent program was blocked in the Fifth Circuit and then later rescinded by the Trump administration. So that stopped that litigation. But other litigation popped up. This particular case was New York, D.C., and I'm going to blank. But, you know, favorable circuits that typically rule when they can, when it's legally supportable on the expansion of immigration as opposed to a restrictionist ideology. So it made its way up, and then here we are. The claims were twofold, equal protection and the Administrative Procedure Act claim, and it's the APA claim that won the day. And so that's a nutshell. Very brief, lots of things omitted, but that's how it wound its way up in the background and against the backdrop of things like, because remember, this litigation was started under the Obama administration. So then we have the Trump administration come in and we have all kinds of immigration litigation going on.
The continuation was Michelle asking a letter we got from Michelle, who says, can Sarah also comment on why DACA recipients do not or have not gotten citizenship? If they've been in this country for most of their lives, it seems like they would be able to apply for citizenship unless there are difficulties that I do not know about. And admittedly, I do not know much about immigration.
Yeah, and I'll let Sienna jump in on this, too, because she knows a little bit more than I do about some of the other people.
Sure.
It's not available to them, essentially, is the short answer. DACA recipients, DACA is prosecutorial discretion. It's a promise from the government not to deport somebody. It is not a pathway to citizenship. The highest privilege that it affords is work authorization, and 90% of DACA recipients are employed. But unless their employer chooses to sponsor them, or they find some other path, or they marry a United States citizen, there really are few pathways to citizenship for this group of folks.
Sienna?
Yeah, and I'll also point out that even if their employer petitions for them or their U.S. citizen spouse petitions for them, what it depends on is whether or not they had a lawful entry into the U.S. So if they had a lawful entry into the U.S., then once they marry a U.S. citizen, or once their employer, which has a lot more technicalities to it, petitions for them, then they would be eligible to apply for a green card here in the U.S. However, if they didn't have a lawful entry to the U.S. and they entered without inspection, then they have to go back to their home country for a consular interview and then reenter. And at that consulate, they will have to account for their unlawful presence in the U.S., which may require a waiver if they were over 18 for longer than a year. So it's very complex. So there is no direct road to citizenship. And that's what's really hard for a lot of our DACA recipients, because they've never been to, they don't remember their home country. So it's hard for them to think about how to leave the country and attempt to reenter.
Anything else you want to add, Sarah?
No, I think, I mean, this just speaks to the complexity of our immigration laws and why we so badly need reform. It's absurd. Good thinking Americans, like the person who wrote the letter, are like, well, you know, shouldn't there be a way? I mean, it seems just obvious that our immigration system should provide pathways to citizenship. But it doesn't, and it hasn't for a very long time. And it's made with the Trump administration in power, they have nearly eviscerated some of the most core values of immigration, including humanitarian protections for children who are abused, abandoned, and neglected. They went after them first. And it's disgusting. It's a real problem. And I think it's because it's so complicated, it's really hard to, you know, in 30 seconds, give your everyday American a snapshot of the life of an immigrant here.
Alan, your thoughts on all this?
Well, there's not much to say except, I'm in awe of the legal discussion that's been going on here. But pardon me. I think it comes down to the fact that we got four really bad guys on the Supreme Court. We've got four liberals who I consider, you know, much more in sympathy with the plight of the people who really need help. And we've got one guy sitting there saying, I've got to preserve the way in which this court is being used or understood, and therefore he gets my admiration for what he's done. But in the end, no matter how complex the legalese is in all of those things, you're going to see those four bad guys lining up to support this president and to support the reactionary element in the United States. And the other four are going to be doing what I consider to be the right, smart, progressive thing. So there you are. I'm in awe, as I say, of the legal discussion. But I really think it's about something, you know, far more obvious to me anyway.
Sarah, anything on that?
No, certainly the composition of the Supreme Court is incredibly important. They really issue, aside from the last several years, they really haven't spent a lot of time in immigration land because of the way that immigration is structured in our laws. So I disagree to the extent that that immigration reform will really be driven by the Supreme Court, right? Or even dependent on it. I think it's more likely, it's really more about Congress. And we had the Gang of Eight, I think they were called, that got really close several years back. And we need to see a resurgence. We also need to see people in the streets. What Black Lives Matter has taught us mm-hmm. is that the people can create the change. And I remember speaking with an elected representative locally, who I won't out, but who was very frustrated with advocates saying, like, where are you? I can't raise up your voice if you're not raising it to me, right? And in en masse, like, this needs to be a movement. And so as movements begin to become more intersectional, I actually think that's where the change will come.
Yeah, but Sarah, I suppose, I don't think we're fighting about this, but if the court had come down the other way, which most people expected that it would, you would have a far different outcome in terms of immigrant rights or DACA rights in the United States, right? I mean, you can say it's not about the courts, it's about the Congress, but yesterday it was about the court.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, and I don't want to minimize the DACA program. There are so many people who are impacted by it, but in the grand scheme of things, it's a fraction of the immigration reform that needs to happen.
Absolutely.
So we celebrate it. It's exciting. It matters to real people who I represent, and so it is a victory. But in the grander, you know, scheme of immigration at large, the Supreme Court has really not influenced it too much directly in ways that would result in either wins or losses. Even the Muslim ban case, right? Although that it was awful, terrible, it's still in place. We're still suffering from it, but it can be undone by the next administration. Right. So the court's role is a bit more limited, I guess.
But they did do something spectacular yesterday, those five justices.
Yes, they did.
Just in the past hour, the president tweeted the Supreme Court. Try it again. The Supreme Court asked us to resubmit DACA. Nothing was lost or won. They punted, much like in a football game, where hopefully they would stand for our great American flag. We will be submitting enhanced papers shortly in order to properly fulfill the Supreme Court's ruling and request of yesterday. I have wanted to take care of DACA recipients better than the do-nothing Democrats, but for 2 years they refused to negotiate. They have abandoned DACA based on the decision the Dems can't make DACA citizens. They gained nothing.
There he goes again.
Sarah?
Yeah, this was definitely something, you know, that a lot of people yesterday raised with me personally, that a lot of pundits and commentators were saying, right? this administration, it took them 4 tries, I think, on the Muslim ban. I have no faith that Stephen Miller is going to be able to craft something that will fulfill the rule of law. They're inherently incapable of it. So they can try, and we will sue, and it will be held in abeyance until such time as a court can, you know, more courts can weigh in on it, and they'll lose the election, and then we won't have to worry about it.
Does he have enough? Does he have enough time to get this done?
I don't think so. No, I think there's lawyers who have been working on this issue for so long that probably have the pleadings pre-drafted in the event that he does this, and they'll file them tomorrow.
And by the time it gets up to the Supreme Court, they're going to be sitting in a room, right, Sarah? And they're going to have to hold up their hands as to whether to grant certiorari to this. And one hand in particular is going to say, no, not this time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point. I think it depends a lot on how the legal challenge is teed up, right, to see what the other issue is that comes up through the litigation. I think we're going to have to be very careful. I'm only a part of a few teams that do this federal litigation, so I'm still a newbie when it comes to that scene. But I know that they've been workshopping. I'm certain they've been drafting for months.
All right, let's move on to another subject before we go to a break at the bottom of the hour. Facebook removed Trump ads with a symbol once used by Nazis to designate political prisoners. Facebook on Thursday deactivated dozens of ads placed by President Trump's re-election campaign that included a symbol once used by the Nazis to designate political prisoners in concentration camps. The marking appeared as part of the campaign's online salvo against Antifa and, quote, far-left groups. A red inverted triangle was used in the 1930s to identify communists and was applied to, as well, to Social Democrats, liberals, Freemasons, and other members of opposition parties incarcerated by the Nazis. The badge forced on Jewish political prisoners, by contrast, featured a yellow triangle overlaid by a red triangle so as to resemble a Star of David. The red triangle appeared in paid posts sponsored by Trump and Vice President Pence, as well as by the Team Trump campaign page. It was featured alongside text warning of dangerous mobs, quote unquote.
and asking users to sign a petition about Antifa, a loose collection of anti-fascist activists whom the Trump administration has sought to link to the recent violence despite arrest records that show their involvement is trivial. Facebook removed the material following queries from the Washington Post, saying ads and organic posts with the inverted triangle violated its policy against organized hate. Andy Stone, a Facebook spokesman, said, quote, "Our policy prohibits using a banned hate group symbol to identify political prisoners without the context that condemns or discusses the symbol." But the ads on the president's page alone, which began running on Wednesday, gained as many 950,000 impressions by Thursday morning. Identical ads on Pence's page gained as many as 500,000 impressions. Alan?
Well, I have a question rather than a comment to the rest of the panel, and that is, we know that Trump is a dope. We know that he doesn't know an awful lot. We know he doesn't think Finland was a country. We know he doesn't think that the Great Britain had a bomb. He just is ignorant. Now, my question to you is, panel, do you think they knew what they were doing when they put that signal on that symbol on there?
I mean, I do, but I don't know what the rest of the group thinks. Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, this is the question, right? Did he know about Juneteenth and Tulsa and the symbolism? Does he know? It's such an odd symbol. When I saw the headline, I was expecting the SS symbol.
Yeah.
Because that's been used by white supremacists who have been documented to be at the protests causing problems, by the way. Militiamen who are white, not Antifa. So most recently, the story broke yesterday about militia in Troy having maybe been present at some of the Black Lives Matter protests. So I was expecting to see more of that element when I read the headline. And then when I saw the pictures, admittedly, this is an area that I need to self-educate about. I didn't know the symbolism of that triangle. But I guarantee you, they do. Stephen Miller is a student of white supremacy. It's not a chance that this is a mistake.
By the way, I agree with you.
Go ahead, Santa.
I had to self-educate myself on the red triangle as well. But I believe it's a dog whistle to the base and to people that understand that.
And sir,
exactly.
And Deborah, go ahead.
No, I agree with Sarah and Sienna. I would not doubt for a moment or think for a moment that they didn't know, he didn't know what was being done. He may not know, I cannot say sitting here that he knows everything, but I think that they have given the okay to move forward in such a direction that makes it known, that will make it known to the group, the racist group, the individuals that they want to understand that they are with them, they are in support of them, they are in support of those types of activities. And so there's no accident here. There's no mistake here. I think a lot of the actions and the behaviors are intentional. And I think it's important for us who don't support that behavior to call it what it is.
Intentional to what end? In other words, why would Americans vote for Trump based on his putting out, a bird whistle or whatever you want to call
it,
for fascism? We fought World War II. You can't get away from it. And yet you think that there's enough people in America to elect him president because he gives us that symbol?
The symbols have been co-opted by these groups that are they're not people who are steeped in historical knowledge, right? So it's more about the symbolism rather than, and not the historical root of the symbolism for the use in the present moment. People, you have these things tattooed on their bodies and they don't understand anything except that they're hate symbols and they are all about hate.
Exactly. And separation of people. And the belief I'm better than those people or different people. So I agree with her. It's not necessarily the full understanding or the knowledge of what it means from the origin, but what it represents in terms of hate and separation of people.
I'll buy it.
You know, I hesitate bringing this up, but I'll bring it up anyway. I had a conversation with a family member. Like many people, you try to navigate these waters, and I have always said throughout this administration that I've been pretty lucky in dealing with my family, who all seem to be on a like page. But I talked to a very dear member of my family who is just, you know, one of my favorite people in the world. And we were talking about this issue yesterday. And I was really shocked that they said to me, well, this, you know, that's obviously not true. That's obviously not what they were what was intended. And Donald Trump, being the Christian, and I will say that this person is of a strong Baptist faith, said, you know, being the Christian that he is, he would not allow that. And when I picked up the scraps of my head off the floor, I just had trouble internalizing it, because I don't get it. I don't understand. I mean, this is to Alan's point of, you know, do they know what they're doing? And I think, yes, we all agree that, yeah, they know what they're doing, and they know very well what they're doing. But this, the way it's received by people as, yes, it's being done, it speaks to the people who want to accept it. And then the other people who support him, who don't want to accept it, believe that he couldn't possibly do it because he is the great savior of God.
Can I ask a question, Joe? Was your correspondent a man or a woman?
A woman.
Oh boy.
there's a targeted campaign to female Trump supporters to paint Trump as a victim, and to call on sort of like the element of the protection of women for him.
Yeah.
And it's been very effective. And what we need are megaphones in the in-groups that these people will listen to, because that there are people that are, you know, within phone distance from me in my life that I could reach out to, who I don't talk to for lots of reasons, including these, who I could reach out to and be totally ineffective at changing their minds. But I think, you know, when top brass in the military issued public statements of regret of being a part of his ridiculous political stunt with the Bible in front of the church, and the protesters were abused and tear gassed, it's those types of megaphones that need to be amplified. And that's what I'm talking about with strategy for November. We have to find those people. And I don't think John Bolton's one of them, but those people that group will listen to, because it's coming from their own in-group. It's coming from the 500,000 impressions, or the, you know, however many impressions. Who are those people that are paying attention to that media, and how do we get to them and interrupt it?
I don't know. I have a wife who made a wonderful T-shirt out of his famous, characterization of women and what he does with them and the rest of it. How could anybody, how could any Christian woman, any Jewish woman, anybody say that this is a guy who represents God? It's just beyond me.
Well, that's, you know, Alan, I was thinking of you yesterday when this was happening to me, because, you know, at some point in this conversation, as we have these conversations, there's a pause in when we're talking on the panel, and you just say, you know, how did we get here? And I came to that point yesterday of, yes, how did we get here? But also, how does a someone who I know and grew up with as someone who is of deep faith and has it rule their life, look at someone like this and find solace in their quote unquote leadership? I understand political differences. I understand if someone said, well, this, if it's strictly on abortion, I understand. But to look at what's done, even in this case of the Nazi symbols, or in the other, and I hate using the word dog whistles, because I think we're beyond that. I mean, they're just screams out the window, aren't they? I mean, sound that are really dog whistles anymore. But it is, it just strikes me that, you know, to have that be such a part and to be bought by people is just, I don't get it. We have to take a break. We'll leave that to be a rhetorical question. And then we'll be back. We'll continue with our group after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Shartok, Sarah Rogerson, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Deborah Brown-Johnson. Last call for letters, and we have about 15 minutes left together this morning. And we go to some of the letters. We will try to get to as many as we can here. Mark says, of course, they know the significance of the symbols they use. Why else would they use it? What graphic artist would suggest it? That from Mark. Evelyn says, we need priests to speak to women of their congregation. These women will listen to their pastors. Also, we got this from Alan, who says, Alan asks how people can think Trump represents God. Read the Bible. God is jealous, angry, misogynistic, racist, anti-science, and closed-minded. It's not that big a leap. Okay. No one wants to touch that, and I don't blame you.
I'll touch it. Not my God, number one. And number two, you write them, we'll read them. That's it.
There you go. There you go. On the subject of Trump as any kind of role model for so-called Christians, I've concluded that no Trump supporter is actually a Christian. No real Christian supports a serial sexual predator who cheated on three wives, puts children in cages, ignores a pandemic, is a racist, lies at unprecedented rate, cares only about himself, and on and on. Those are not even close to the Christian values I grew up with. Well, that's the thing, Leslie. They do, though. That's the question.
Yes, they do. They absolutely do. And you sit next to them in church. I mean, this is part of the anti-racist work that needs to happen. If you sit in pews in faith communities, especially in rural parts of this listening area, it is time to speak up, because they will listen to you at coffee hour before they will listen to us on the radio.
Great point. Loretta says, true. How can Catholics support Trump and believe he is a Christian? I only know what I learned from my mother, an educated and thoughtful woman who supported him. The New York Catholic News and other publications from the church told their followers that they needed to, because he was supporting the protection of the unborn, the sanctity of marriage between a man and a woman, and not non-heterosexual policies. For example, a subtlety often missed is that Christian groups do not want their tax dollars to support non-Christian policies like abortion. Sandra says, seems to me that 45's misogyny and racism might resonate with Christian sects who believe as a matter of doctrine that women and people of color are not fully human and therefore must be made to submit. We go to Michael, who says, symbols of hatred collected from the Nazis, the Confederacy, and other sources are the language by which Trump communicates with his base. Disrespecting sacred dates is part of that culture of hatred. Every vile act is a thinly veiled signal of the racism that they celebrate together. It is not incidental. It is the main point. Deborah, anything on that?
I think that's true. I think that was the earlier point, that this is intentional. And I do want to say one thing in terms of, I think historically in this country, people have used the Bible to promote segregation, racism, you know, any evil that they perceived. I think it was no accident. It was intentional when in Washington, when he walked across Lafayette Square, in front of the church, it was to give a message. I'm here. You see what has been done to this church, and I'm here to protect it. And I'm holding up this Bible, even if it's upside down or backwards, it doesn't matter. And those who want to believe, or who believe that one, a white man is the savior, who want to believe that this particular man is, you know, some of his policies and beliefs are good, and that they believe in that and they support that, they will support what is put in front of them. it will take, I think, as Sarah is saying, I agree with that, that those who, others that they also respect and see the glaring issue have to speak to it. This is not, this at this moment, at this time, we can no longer be silent. We can no longer say, leave it for someone else. We can't say it's okay. Somebody will take care of it. It's not my business. It is our business. It is about how we are going to live our lives collectively. And so it's important for people who disagree to present that, to bring it up, to challenge our elected officials, to say that that position is not representative of me and my community, to, and as had been spoken about earlier, we absolutely must vote. We not only must register to vote, we must vote, and then we must go forward and ensure that the issues that are representing us, that are of our concern, are on the forefront, that we must continue to keep folks accountable who are in the office. Even if the person who gets in is not the one you voted for, the position is the position that's supposed to represent the people. And so you challenge them. You challenge him or her. And we must do that. We can no longer be silent to what is happening. And I think the things that we're seeing going on, it's happening because people say, I have to. I have to and I must. And those who are not need to join in and make it known, make their voice known.
Anyone else to respond to that or to echo?
You know,
I just want
to. I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
Go ahead,
yeah, I just want to chime in that I think we'd have a very different Democratic candidate if the move, if the Black Lives Matter movement, if George Floyd's death had resonated, if Tamir Rice's death had resonated, if the lives that have been lost previously had resulted in what we're seeing now, I wonder if how that would have impacted. Would we have defaulted to a white male savior on the Democrats' side? And I'm glad that the conversation is changing so much more forcefully. And I hope that Joe Biden is listening and doing the learning that he needs to do to be effective mm-hmm. in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a political science question. Amy Klobuchar gets on Rachel Maddow last night, Alan, and says, I'm out of the running. He needs to name a woman of color as his vice presidential choice. Joe Biden does. So does she do that to save herself, or is she asked to do that to clear the way?
Well, my sense immediately was she knew she wasn't going to get it.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, this was a face saver, but you never know. You know, she certainly is right in saying it should be somebody of color and it should be a female. We know that. And I think it's clear that that's where Joe Biden is going to go. I would think Kamala Harris fits the bill, except for the fact that she was so forceful against Biden during the primary. But think of all the things that the Republicans had to say about Trump, who are now his biggest butt kissers of, you
right.
know, of all Ted Cruz and everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, these people are interested in winning. Now, in terms of the letter, I can only say that the African-American vote is what made Joe Biden the candidate. They like him. They like the fact that he was, you know, the vice president under Barack Obama. I think this is where we're going. I mean, I think Biden should not be underestimated in terms of the affection that African-American people have for him. I mean, that's what the primaries proved.
Sarah?
I could quibble with that. But
I'm surprised.
There was a movement. There was a point in the primaries where it was very clear that every single candidate left in the running had been had received the phone call that the game plan was to withdraw and endorse Joe Biden.
Well, that's true.
But that was more about Bernie Sanders, right?
Yes, it was.
But what I'm saying is, had that moment been matched to this moment, when I say it that way, the political calculus has just shifted dramatically. And
you don't think Bernie Sanders would have gotten that vote, do you?
No, I don't. I think we'd have, I think we might have a Booker or a Harris getting higher numbers. And certainly the way that there has been a whole string of stories about Elizabeth and how she has been very quietly but meaningfully engaged in the movement right now.
Elizabeth
and
Warren?
Elizabeth Warren. Lizzie, as I call her.
Okay. so everyone knows.
She's been so, you know, if we can call Joe, we can call Elizabeth.
Yeah, that's right.
She has been so right on and so present and was also gaining steam among African-American voters. And I think we need to make the distinction, Black voters. So politics is messy. I want to raise the point that it wasn't necessarily in the bag for Biden, and he had a lot of problems on the trail. And I wish we had a representation in the White House that represented something other than the history of white men occupying that seat.
But you may have that depending on who he chooses for vice president.
But vice president's like a consolation prize.
Not necessarily. Not this time.
Not if you're a one-termer.
Yeah. No. That's
well,
fair.
You know, I have a certain amount of a difference of opinion as a political scientist here. I think that the American people, and the reason they went for Biden is that they were looking for a moderate. They didn't want somebody way out there. That's why Bernie Sanders never got what he wanted. You know, the people who listen to this radio station are not representative of what I'm talking about. But I'm telling you that the main thing for so many Democrats, including me, and I'll take responsibility for this, is to get Trump the hell out of there. And they think, and there are those who think, that Biden is the best way to do that. He is a moderate. There's no question about it. And therefore, he gets a lot of the vote that some of the other guys or women would not have gotten.
I want to just, because we're almost out of time, we have less than a minute, and I just want to get to this one thing, because we were talking about Trump and white women and the efforts. Sarah was mentioning this, the efforts. We were learning today that Congresswoman from this region, Elise Stefanik of the 21st District, will be speaking at President Trump's rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma on Saturday. And she'll be joining Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton and Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan at the rally. Alan, any thoughts?
Will she wear a mask?
I can only guess no, but I don't know. We will see. My thanks to everybody. A great group this morning. I appreciate you all being here. Alan Chartok, have a beautiful weekend. Thank you very much, as always.
Okay, gang, you too. Everybody, be safe.
Thank you. Sarah Rogerson, great to have you back. Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, wonderful to have you on the program. And Deborah Brown-Johnson, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Best to you all. Have a good weekend. We'll be back with the Congressional Corner right after this.